This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, an update on the Asian bird flu. But first, during his visit to Europe this week, President Bush said that emerging technologies would solve the problem of climate change, and that, quote, technologies such as hydrogen-powered vehicles, electricity from renewable energy sources, and clean coal technology will encourage economic growth that is environmentally responsible, end quote. Well, for the United States, which leads the world in greenhouse gas emissions, talking about a high-tech fix is, of course, cheap. Actually doing something about it on a national scale, well, that's something a little bit different. But that has not deterred some countries who are doing more than just talking about greenhouse technologies. They're making a serious investment into cutting back their CO2 emissions. So this hour, we're going to take a look at some of those countries and the technologies they're using, like wind power in Germany, Denmark, and Great Britain, hydrogen in Tokyo, renewables in Costa Rica. And how much can these technologies mitigate greenhouse gas emissions without U.S. participation in the Kyoto Protocol or even a U.S. national effort? Plus, is nuclear power poised to make a comeback as a green technology? Could fusion finally be on the horizon? If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Jennifer Morgan is the director of the Climate Change Program for the World Wildlife Fund International in Berlin, Germany. She joins us today by phone from Istanbul, Turkey. Good evening. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you for staying up late for us.
Sure.
Peter Schwartz is the co-author of The Long Boom, A Vision for the Coming Age of Prosperity, published by Perseus Books. He is chairman and co-founder of Global Business Network in Emeryville, California. He joins us from Monterey. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks, Ira.
Yeah, you're welcome. Jennifer Morgan, let's talk about some of these technologies and some of the countries that are using them. You work in Berlin. Isn't Germany a big producer of wind-powered electricity as well as some other countries in Europe?
Absolutely. Germany has made a major investment in wind, along with Denmark, and Spain's markets are growing rapidly. The numbers were just released. Over 9% of electricity in Germany is powered by renewable energy. And much of that in wind, and they're aiming to have 20% of their primary energy powered by renewables by 2020. So they're really out there, and the technology is taken off in a very big way.
What is the single biggest thing a country can do to cut back on emissions of greenhouse gases?
Well, a country needs to put together a whole package of policies that put a price on CO2 and get fuel switching into less carbon-polluting fuels, like from coal into gas and into renewables. They need to make their whole economy much more efficient. Energy efficiency is absolutely key and is obviously also good for the pocketbook. And they need to support renewable energies coming into the market. And so you really need a whole suite to focus in and make these things happen, and then they really take off, and it's a very exciting economic opportunity for the country.
Yeah, we've heard people talking about just increasing the miles per gallon. The CAFE standards, as they say, for cars would do a tremendous amount.
Absolutely, and China gets it. China is working on increasing its fuel economy standards to much higher, actually, than U.S. standards, and you know, looking to really deal with some of their energy security issues as well.
Is China going to set the standard for the world? And you know, because what it demands, the other people will want to make.
I think China is on the way to do that. They, from my experience, understand both the fact that from air pollution and energy security, they need to switch to renewable energy, and they're working on a law that would actually have 12% of their energy be from renewables by 2020, which is just a huge number. And they get the climate change issue as well. So they're doing this for a whole range of reasons. And my experience with them is once they get going, it's hard to stop them.
Yet they didn't sign on to Kyoto. Why was that?
Well, China actually has signed on to Kyoto, but they have slightly different commitments than the developed countries. They don't have legally binding targets yet. But they do have a series of policies they're supposed to implement, and they're actually doing quite a lot on that, much more than the United States is, in fact. Mm-hmm.
Peter Schwartz, you've written a lot about hydrogen. You say it can save America. But is it feasible? I mean, considering what an infrastructure it would require?
It's a great question. I might say, by the way, I arrived back here at the hotel from the TED conference in a GM fuel cell hydrogen vehicle. And that vehicle, I think, represents all the issues that are associated with what you've just suggested. I mean, the thing you pointed to is the infrastructure for distribution of hydrogen. But we have an interesting opportunity that I think most people don't realize in that respect. We already have a hydrogen economy around the major refinery complexes in the United States. There are about 9 major such refinery complexes, one in the San Francisco Bay Area, North Jersey, Galveston, Louisiana, Long Beach, and so on. Around those, there are chemical plants. You know, when you have hydrogenated fats, where does the hydrogen come from? It comes out of that refinery. And you both use and produce hydrogen in the production of oil at a refinery. And so there's a fair amount of refinery that flows over the refinery, a fair amount of hydrogen that flows over the refinery walls, either by pipe or by truck, to local processing plants for other purposes, production of plastics, for example. And so we already have, in some places in the United States, Richmond, California, for example, outside the Chevron refinery, a hydrogen fueling station for experimental buses that are running as part of a trial in the San Francisco East Bay area. So the way that infrastructure will develop will be where it naturally develops already, and we'll see fleet vehicles like taxis and buses and trucks and so on being able to use those kinds of hydrogen filling stations as the vehicles begin to come on stream.
But that hydrogen, though, is not going to save us any greenhouse gases, is it? I mean, that hydrogen has a waste product of carbon dioxide, does it not?
That's right. And so this is a chicken and the egg question. And it'll reduce somewhat the amount of greenhouse gases because we're going to, in fact, improve the efficiency of use of the net production of hydrocarbons in that process. So there is some gain, but it's not huge. Mm-hmm. It's not as fundamental as when you start extracting, say, hydrogen from water or other processes for generating hydrogen. That having been said, you know, this is several steps along the way. So one step is having enough infrastructure to create enough vehicles. Once you have enough vehicles, then you have multiple fuel sources. And so over the next 30 years or so, we'll begin to make that transition fairly dramatically, starting sometime between 2010 and 2015, toward more and more hydrogen vehicles.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to have to reach some critical number of cars on the roads using, let's say, fuel cells before they're cheap enough to make them en masse and to make them affordable.
Well, that's right. And so what will happen is that first it'll be a premium vehicle, just like the hybrids are today. The price differential, by the time you know they get to be introduced, will be probably something on the order of $5,000. So, in other words, you'll have to pay $5,000 more for a very clean fuel cell hydrogen vehicle or a vehicle that burns hydrogen, even an internal combustion engine. So you're going to pay some substantial premium initially, and, you know, the people who are motivated because of clean, green motivations are going to be the ones who buy those early on. But remember, there's also a high probability that we'll see higher prices for gasoline also about the same time. So the consumer motivation for reducing their cost from gasoline prices will also begin to grow.
Mm-hmm. We have Jennifer was just talking about the rise of wind power in Germany, Great Britain, and Denmark, other places in Europe. We've seen sort of a fledgling wind power rise here, but we haven't seen sort of an infrastructure where we can hook them all together in a grid so that if one wind's not blowing in one place, it's blowing in another, and they can back each other up, and also to service places where if you stick the leads from the windmills in the water, you get hydrogen out of it. What is it going to take to change that infrastructure?
Well, it's a question of being able to have enough distributed wind so that it's blowing somewhere all the time, mm-hmm. Having enough transmission capacity. I personally doubt we're going to get for a long time to the situation where we're generating a lot of our baseload electricity from wind. I think wind has enormous potential. Don't misunderstand me. And I think we're going to do as much wind as we can possibly do. But I think it isn't going to replace, unfortunately, the coal plants that are a really big problem for CO2.
Jennifer Morgan?
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I think that if you mix wind and biomass with energy efficiency, there's no reason why you can't do it. I mean, the base load, obviously, you do need to have some constant stream happening there. But I think that with the right, I come back to this legal policy framework, these types of distributional issues that you raise can be dealt with and can have tremendous benefits for example, the farming community who has a lot of land, for example, out in the Northwest that they love to put wind farms on, or in the Midwest where they're interested in woody biomass, so kind of woody plant, cellulosic ethanol is the term that's used, that could really fill in that mix so that we don't need to build any new coal-fired power plants in the U.S. and meet our electricity needs.
And I think that's basically right, but the issue that I think we have to drive toward is actually driving out a lot of the coal that we're already producing, let alone building new coal plants, because I think the climate change issue is so urgent. And there, unfortunately, I think the real alternative that we have to confront is nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president, before we get to nuclear power, the president is his administration is pushing efforts to recover the carbon dioxide out of coal when you're on your way to making hydrogen and put it back in the ground.
We're going to do that. I think that is worth doing. At the moment, it is both expensive and messy and somewhat controversial, i.e., where do you bury the CO2? What technology do you use it? Do you put it down in mines, deep ocean, and so on? And there are a number of issues about how can you really permanently sequester that carbon. But I think we're going to do it no matter what in any event, because I think it is important and worth doing. But I think it's going to be a bit slower than we would like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing that I worry about on this is the fact that certainly the Bush administration and others are looking at this sequestration, this coal capture and storage, as the answer, when, as Peter mentions, we're not there yet, and it's expensive, and renewables and energy efficiency are ready now. So in some ways, you need to have two tracks happening.
All right. Let me interrupt. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Peter Schwartz and Jennifer Morgan. Take your questions on alternative energies. How would you like to see them happen? Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about technological approaches for mitigating climate change and global warming through storing up or getting rid of greenhouse gases with my guests, Peter Schwartz, co-author of The Long Boom, A Vision to the Coming Age of Prosperity, Jennifer Morgan, director of the Climate Change Program for the World Wildlife Fund International, our number 1-800-989-8255. Jennifer, tell us, I was reading a really interesting report about Costa Rica deriving 92% of its energy from renewable sources. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, Costa Rica and a number of other countries have managed to put together an interesting mix. They have a lot of hydropower, so that helps them have that high of a share, and they also, I think, use quite a bit of biomass in their energy mix as well. But a country like Costa Rica or New Zealand or Iceland are all very high up on those percentages.
Mm-hmm. If we did what a lot of these countries are doing, or we just try to follow them, how much impact could all of these technologies have on warming? Could it be enough to slow warming in, say, the absence of a binding emission targets like the Kyoto Protocol?
Well, I think we need to do both. I think, and if you look at a country like Germany, it's a good example, because putting a price on CO2 pollution is quite an important thing to get the market moving and get those switches happening. But actually, also, really putting together a new Apollo project for these technologies is also tremendously exciting and important. But you need to put it all together in that package, or you don't get there fast enough. And the window, unfortunately, is closing pretty quickly.
Peter Schwartz, is there any political will in this country to do that kind of stuff?
Well, I think you have to separate the states and the population from the current Bush administration philosophy and policy. And I think you would find, even in the Republican Party, a strong sentiment in favor of a cleaner, greener planet and for dealing with climate change. And then, of course, you find in a number of states like California, where I live and work, significant movement in that direction in the policy world. And I think, frankly, what is about to happen is I think you're going to see the beginnings of a shift in national policy as well, as the national leadership, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, begin to see their own party begin to turn, and the states, Republican governors like Schwarzenegger, Kentucky, Romney in Massachusetts, and so on, all beginning to respond to some of these because Washington has abdicated. So I think we'll see the political will begin to change even in America.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tony Blair, very close to the president, working on him on the global warming questions.
Exactly. That was the main subject of his speech at Davos. And that's, you know, and Bush owes Blair a big favor.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Before we get to the phones, let's talk a little bit about nuclear fusion. You mentioned before, Peter, that that we're talking about nuclear energy now as a green energy. A lot of people are still concerned about the waste produced by nuclear power.
Well, we have to separate nuclear fission from fusion. You mentioned fusion. Fusion is the energy of the sun, you know, basically igniting hydrogen and produce helium. We're working on that, but it has been 30 years off for the last 50 years. And it remains 30 years
That's
off.
Right.
And in fact, I was just out at Livermore Labs a couple of weeks ago. They're hoping to get what's called the National Ignition Facility going in less than 5 years, and that'll be the first experiments for the new kind of technology. So I think that's a long way off.
Mm-hmm.
More relevant is nuclear fission, today's reactors, and the next generation of better technologies. And we're seeing a whole array of new technologies that are safer, cheaper, easier to manage, more resilient with respect to the nuclear fuel cycle. There are risks. I think we can't underestimate the magnitude of the risks of nuclear power, but the risks of climate change are much, much, much greater. And we can't afford to abandon any options, not renewables, not nuclear, even clean coal, in the face of the risks of climate change. Climate change, in my opinion, is a civilizational crisis like we've never faced before. And we can't afford to abandon any of those options, including nuclear fission.
Jennifer Morgan, would you agree?
Well, I don't think I totally agree with the scale and the urgency of this challenge. And I think that leaders like Blair and others are right to put this on the agenda in that way. But I guess I think that the other technologies that are out there, like the energy efficiency measures, like the renewables pieces, can move us quite far. We can move to a carbon-free power sector in developed countries by 2050 without going to nuclear, and even with a nuclear phase-out in many countries that are looking that way. So
yes.
I think that we should be putting our energy into those, making those technologies possible, rather than going back to an issue where there's still quite a number of problems to be dealt with.
And so it really is a question of how you would judge the risk of the imminence of climate change. And if you think it is imminent, as I do, and that the magnitude of the change is potentially very large, then you're potentially willing to take the risks of nuclear power, as I see it. And that I don't think you can drive out enough of the coal with renewables, i.e. with wind and photovoltaics and efficiency, to really make a difference in greenhouse gases, particularly when you think about the next 1.5 to 2 billion consumers coming on stream in the next 50 years in China and India and elsewhere. We're all going to need electricity. China needs 1,000 megawatts a month and is building 30 nuclear plants to begin to respond to that. Now, Jennifer's right. They're doing everything they can to do this as clean and green as possible, but the alternative they face is nasty brown coal. And so that's one of the reasons they're moving to nuclear. They're going to have natural gas. They're going to do everything. But I think we are faced with that very terrible dilemma, either abrupt climate change or nuclear power. And we're not going to like what the consequences of abrupt climate change are likely to be.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Nathan in Oregon. Hi, Nathan.
Talking about imminence of climate change, I'm here in what normally would be a very overcast area, heating my solar hot tub with solar panels. And it's, you know, this is happening. It's, unfortunately, it's not happening fast enough to, like, knock the door down and get people off their butts and do something about it, because we don't, you know, we're not going to have the time once it gets to that point. But my main comment was, on cars, I think we need to reevaluate our attitude about cars. I mean, my theory is that they're like cars are to the planet what the AIDS virus is to the human body. I mean, the little microorganism that chips away at the defenses, and you know, eventually the host dies. But you know, Bush's energy budget, $27 billion for oil drilling and $100 million for all renewables combined. I might have even got axed further down than that. I think our priorities are way off, and I think, you know, we need to rethink this whole idea about how we get around in society. We could go you could travel faster 100 years ago by train from city to city in this country than you can now. And I just think, you know, there's a lot of things we can do, starting with conservation, especially like built-in design, solar siding. We should get tax breaks for that kind of stuff instead of, you know, free Hummers. I mean, it's just becoming a joke.
All right, Nathan, thanks for calling.
Well, you look at Oregon, for example. Oregon has had a very thoughtful, far-sighted energy policy. The city of Portland has done a very good job of dealing with these kinds of issues. But unfortunately, most of the world still wants cars.
I think the University of Oregon, if I remember correctly, was working on wave energy now, trying to be one of the big wave energy research centers. 1-800-989-8255. Greg in North Brantford, Connecticut. Hi, Greg.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi.
Hey, I'd like to have Peter, if you would, address the issue of hydrogen. I think there's a little bit of a scam that goes on with regard to this in terms of the energy balance. If you're talking about getting hydrogen from water, that's not a very efficient process. It costs a lot of energy to create hydrogen from water, and then you burn it. Right now, the only places we get hydrogen from, as far as I know, are from petroleum sources. So we're not eliminating our need for petroleum. We're just changing how we're using it. So could he talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's a critical point. And the issue really is, what is the energy source you use to produce the hydrogen if you're extracting it from water, you know, the classic electrolysis? And, you know, as Jennifer suggested, we can use renewables to some extent for that purpose, wind, photovoltaics, and so on. And we'll do, I think, a lot of that where that works and where it can be made to work infrastructurally. But in the end, if we're really going to drive out oil and replace oil in the long run in our transportation fleets, then we're going to need to produce such a volume in so many places that I think we're going to need something like nuclear power to produce the electricity to produce the hydrogen. And there are particular kinds of nuclear plants that operate at exceptionally high temperatures and use a variety of different processes for generating the hydrogen that will continue to improve in their efficiency and come down in cost over time. But this won't be really cheap. We should recognize this. This is not going to be cheap. But oil by that time will be running out and will definitely not be cheap. So the competitor technologies will be also, frankly, fairly expensive.
Thank you, Greg. Let's go to Sarah in Paradise, California. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was wondering why solar power, you guys mentioned a little bit, but why it can't be used on a... We're in California, and it's a little bit different, but I'm really frustrated by the fact that there's so much...
Why is there more solar? Why not more solar power? Jennifer, can you answer that?
Yeah, like on all the houses and everything, too. Yeah. So, and I'll take my answer off.
Okay.
I mean, I think that the growth in the solar uptake and market has been tremendous, but
yes,
it just is taking a bit more time. And I see that, number one, it depends on the type of support mechanisms are being put in for it and the actual application of it. But I think it's just a matter of time, and certainly solar water heaters are taking off.
Well, there have been cities and states that have totally dismantled their solar. I mean, if I remember reading correctly, that Florida had a huge roof solar, hot water heating system, right before World War II, and then it got dismantled after the war.
So what we're doing now is we're doing a lot with photovoltaics on rooftops of commercial buildings, hospitals, shopping malls. A little company in Berkeley, California, Powerlight, builds these big tiles that they can cover rooftops with. Now, the truth is you still need a subsidy, but the other side of it is that the demand is so great where there's a slight subsidy that they're flat out. And essentially every plant in the world today is making solar cells, is operating flat out. So there really is a demand, and there's lots and lots of places where we can still go very, very far with solar local power applications in many parts of the world, and that's why it's growing fast. It's doubling almost every year.
Mm-hmm. And if you go around Europe, especially in the Middle East, you see hot water heaters on just about everybody's roofs.
That's very common.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about alternative energies this hour. Let's see if we can get a couple of calls in. Martha, is it Huachuca, Arizona?
Yes, Huachuca City.
Hi, go ahead.
I want to say that on the 4th and 5th and 6th of March in Tucson, National Mensa has a colloquium called Earth in Mind, Fueling the Future, which is exactly what we're talking about today. There are still a few spaces left, and if one is interested, go to colloquium.us.mensa.org and sign up.
All right, we'll get those brains working on it. Thanks for calling, Martha.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Jennifer, where do you put your leverage? Where can you exert most of your influence, do you think?
Well, I think it needs to happen in a number of different places. I mean, one example on talking about hydrogen, and that is the largest oil company in Argentina, which basically wants to do green hydrogen for export because they have potentially huge wind in Patagonia. Now, you look at this project and you think this is the dreamland, but these are the types of things that we need to figure out how to make happen. So I think that working with the business leaders and political leaders who get this and then giving them the support and creating the business opportunities to make it happen is where a bunch of the leverage needs to happen. And I think in many developing countries, the other leverage, of course, is that people don't want, not only in developing countries, but they don't want dirty coal-fired power plants in their backyards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a movement across in the Philippines and in Thailand with local communities shutting down local, you know, coal-fired power plants and then looking to renewables. And so I think, you know, working on the community level, but then really creating the business opportunities and the right policy framework is where we need to be heading.
We're talking about alternative energies this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So a country or a part of a country could go into the energy business by getting relatively cheap, if they have a lot of wind, putting up the wind turbines, turning it into hydrogen and shipping it around the world.
That that is the vision of this Argentinian oil company. Now, you know, we need to create, you know, there's all this talk about developing countries taking action. You know, and you have some great examples of China and India and in this case Argentina, but we need to figure out how to give them the support to make it happen, and you need to couple it with energy efficiency. You often hear how expensive renewables can be, but if you put together this package, you know, if we're looking for a carbon-free power sector, which is very possible, then you need to also get your savings, your cost savings, from saving money on electricity. We waste so much of our energy when we generate electricity around the world, and especially in the U.S., and that just needs to be addressed, and that'll help finance quite a lot of these transitions.
Mm-hmm. We hear the president talk a lot about one of the problems is that there are economic hardships with cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions.
I think that is mostly irrelevant. I think it is in fact a red herring. Almost everywhere we've looked where you see environmental investment, there's a net gain in jobs, net gain in employment. I think his big concern is Detroit. And I think the real issue is getting GM and Ford to compete with Toyota effectively and assure that they have the vehicles necessary as we necessarily make the transition. The only real place which, if you get serious about this, where there will be a net negative employment effect is in coal mining. And that's real, and I don't think there's much you can do about that if you're serious about driving out coal.
Yeah, neither Bush or Kerry wanted to offend the coal miners on the last election by coming out heavily for alternative energies. That's why they were going toward using coal as a source for hydrogen.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's going to take some sort of national effort, some coordinated effort to make something like that happen in this country.
I think that's right. But, you know, since Washington isn't doing it, you know, the states are. Because they are close to the people, and they actually have to respond to the realities of, you know, they have public utility commissions that have to site power plants and the like and actually deliver the electricity to people. So I think if Washington doesn't, it's going to come from the states, which is not the best solution, but it's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I think, too, that the thing that will hopefully start to hit is with the Kyoto Protocol entering into force, with these other countries moving forward, that the market opportunities are going elsewhere. And if you want to be in, I don't think Detroit wants to go back to the 1970s again, and it's heading that way with Toyota taking on these hybrid vehicles and California hopefully being able to finally implement a law to decrease CO2 emissions, this type of thing. And you know, sooner or later, hopefully the message will hit that they're losing economic opportunity by not being in Kyoto and by not addressing this issue.
Jennifer, Peter, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for having us.
Jennifer Morgan is director of the Climate Change Program for the World Wildlife Fund International in Berlin, Germany. Peter Schwartz, co-author of The Long Boom, A Vision for the Coming Age of Prosperity, that was published by Perseus in 2000. He's chairman and co-founder of the Global Business Network in Emeryville, California. We're going to take a short break, come back, switch gears, and get an update on the bird flu. There have been a couple of developments there, tests of a vaccine going on this week in the United States. Tony Fauci will join us along with other experts. So stay with us. We'll be right back.